You're listening to The Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 19th of January 2022 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
How many minutes to midnight are we now? Should everyone's election campaigns be shorter? And one California town's plans for avoiding a live-action remake of Hitchcock's The Birds. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily in association with Allianz starts now. Hello and welcome to The Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Holly Dagres and Yossi Meckelberg will discuss all the day's big stories, and we'll hear from the New York Times' Peter Goodman about his new book, Considering the Cult of Davos Man. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on The Monocle Daily, in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is The Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined today by Yossi Meckelberg, Associate Fellow with the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House, and by Holly Dagres, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Curator of the Iranist newsletter. Hello to you both.
Hello.
By way of cunningly foreshadowing our and finally item today, I did want to start by asking you both, I'll ask you first, Holly, what was the last time you were actually, I don't know, marauded, menaced, or otherwise beset by wildlife?
I would say February 2020, I was in Wyoming visiting my in-laws, and we were in Jackson Hole, and there was a bison on the road, and they were lost, and they were running around on the road blocking traffic, and people were worried about their cars getting hit.
They would be as well. I don't think you really realize it until you see bison up close, as I have. You don't want to be on the receiving end of that.
No, and unfortunately, we've read countless incidents in Wyoming where tourists get too close and they get mauled to death.
Well, that's a cheerful start to the show. Actually, it does get more depressing from here on now that I think of the running order. Yossi, what about you?
Well, we just discovered that we both have in-laws in Wyoming. So it's
you're literally related. This is amazing.
They're different in-laws. but yes, actually, in Wyoming, a moose and a cub, which obviously you don't upset them when you meet them on the way to a waterfall. So there was a bit of a standoff of 40-45 minutes, and they didn't bother us, we didn't bother them, but we're all safe. But it could have gone differently.
God, I feel like I should have led with my own most recent one, which was getting bitten on the foot by a swan when I was standing next to a canal in King's Cross in London. My hazardous interactions with wildlife index has dropped off precipitously since I left Australia. I may call back to childhood incidents later in the show, but we will start today with doomsday, getting the difficult stuff out of the way first. Specifically, the doomsday clock, more the plaything of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. Tomorrow, on its 75th anniversary, the boffins of the apocalypse will intone their annual announcement of whether we are closer or further to self-inflicted extinction than this time last year. The clock currently reads 100 seconds to midnight, its grimmest ever estimate, and certainly away from the 17 entire minutes it blew out to circa the end of the Cold War in the early 90s. Yossi, potentially quite the week for it, what with Russian armour massing on the Ukrainian border, prepared to cry havoc and let slip the dogs of etc. Do you think it will go forward or backward?
I think it will go backwards.
Really?
I don't think...
We have an optimist at the table.
About time. I think comparing where it all started in 1953, and I can say that my research in the past was about revolution and concentrating on Cuba and the United States. I thought it should have been much further than what happened in these 14 days. Oliver Stone got it wrong about the 13 days.
14 Oliver Stone wrong? Surely.
On occasion.
Surely you jest.
It's 14 days in October there. I think it was much closer. So if this is the kind of calculation, how the variables, I still think that the war in the Ukraine can be avoided. I think as long as they get what they want, in the sense that the Ukraine's not saying, because it's in their constitution, but at least imply they are not going to join NATO, and the United States, we are not going to push for this. I think it can be avoided.
Holly, do you think we really are, as the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists seem to believe, in greater danger now than during peak Cold War? Because the closest it got prior to where it is now was 2 minutes inspiring the Iron Maiden song of the same name. And that was in 1953 after H-bomb tests.
Well, I have to say, are people really paying close attention to that clock anymore? It doesn't mean that
are.
The date... We are. But, I mean, when the news breaks, is it something that's going to keep people up at night the way it did in the 50s? I would say no, but that doesn't mean the dangers are gone. It means the dangers are different. Back then, it was the threat of nuclear war. Now, it's climate change. It's... divisions in governments like the United States under Trump with the January 6th insurrection. It's, yes, we have this potential of something breaking out between Ukraine and Russia and whatnot. But I get the sense that the doomsday scenario isn't as close as we think. I think there's pressing issues there that we should be paying attention to. But is it keeping everybody awake at night? I wouldn't say no.
I mean, Yossi, does the clock tell us anything really other than the fact that there's, you know, a bunch of Poindexters who enjoy being on television once a year?
Probably. And it gives us something to talk about it. But at the same time, I completely agree with what Holly says. There are a lot of issues, that unresolved issue, from pandemic to climate change to breakdown populism. It's not only in the United States, it's almost everywhere right now. And to deal with all of that. Now, if all of them come together at the same time in the wrong way, probably the clock will move closer than only 100, say, towards doomsday. But then you take that all these variables are going at the same time, moving in the same unfortunate direction, and then we are doomed.
I mean, Holly, it's not an exact science, obviously, but does it serve any purpose, do you think, as a call to action? Or is it, as I rather suspect, more likely that it actually inculcates a kind of fatalism, whichever way you tilt it? Because if you blow it out to 15 or 20 minutes to midnight, everyone will go, oh, fine, everything's great, carry on. But if it is, you know, 100 seconds, it's basically saying, we're all doomed.
I think it's a mix of both. We definitely want people to pay attention that everything is in hunky-dory. We just named a list of issues that are affecting all of us, essentially, right now. And we should be paying attention, and that's the problem here. We have politicians saying things but not taking action. And as a people, we shouldn't be ignoring that. We should be more outspoken and wanting more from our governments to address these important issues that are affecting all of us. So I think that the clock maybe hints at that a bit more.
Okay, well, let's move along while we wait to see what they've decided this time tomorrow, because it is a common and indeed reasonable complaint among the weary citizens of democracies that the politicians elected to run their countries end up finding themselves obliged to spend more time and energy campaigning for re-election than actually governing during the term they have already won. It is possible that Portugal may have an answer. It has a general election looming on January 30th, and the official campaigning period ahead of it began on January 16th. Now, Holly, first of all, obviously you can't compress the entire election into 2 weeks, and obviously a certain amount of spruiking and shilling for votes will have gone on beforehand. But in general, especially as I'm sure, long-suffering veteran of the American political system with its perpetual campaign, do you quite like the idea of knocking it off in a fortnight?
Yes and no. I mean, but it seems like it was kind of a snap election, too, where it came out of the blue. So I don't think people were expecting it. And that short amount of time kind of surprises people. Whereas in the United States, yes, it's perpetual. We're always expecting it. And we know what candidates we usually are interested in, at least with members of Congress. So I think the differences are there.
I mean, the difference, obviously, is I think a probably inevitable consequence of the American system of fixed terms is that because everybody knows when the election is years in advance, everybody starts campaigning. And of course, under a system where it's in the gift or at the whim of the prime minister to call an election, no one really knows when that's going to happen. But that being the case, Yossi, if that option is there, do you prefer a lengthy, interminable, thorough test of the candidates and their ideas, or would you rather get it over with quickly?
In ideal world, it is really the time for societies to address all the pressing issues of the time, really things that mean to us. In the age of social media and populism, 3 days is probably too much for election. Sure. Because it's not actually going in-depth in dealing with all the issues. It's how bad is the other side and how we incite against that. Now, on a serious point, actually election starts from the very day that's the last one came to an end, because the government positioned itself sets the policies, and this is the manifesto for the 4 or 5 years, depends on the length of the term, and the opposition should respond to that. This actually, what we see as election campaigns, should be kind of the peak of all of it after the end of the term. But what we see is actually, because of populism, because of social media, is trying to earn as many cheap points and possible, and hence rather have it in 2 weeks than prolong it.
I mean, Holly, there is this idea that is floated in the United States that there is a virtue to the perpetual campaign, certainly as it applies to presidents. And this is the idea that obviously if you end up in that job, you have signed up for something, you know, fairly physically and psychologically stressful. So it makes a certain amount of sense to put them through this excruciating obstacle course beforehand to, you know, prove that they can stand it.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely an argument to be made there. But just looking at members of Congress, we have some dinosaurs in Congress. And I mean, we do have term limits, but I mean, in terms of every 4 years for members of the Senate that get elected and whatnot. But when I look at that, some of these people have been in there for a generation at least. And I would like actual limits to members of Congress staying in office. And I think that's something that I would like to see. When it comes to American politics, because one thing I've noticed is that there's a disconnect between members of Congress and the people. I'll give you an example. When we've been having these things about Facebook, we've seen members of Congress that don't understand how Facebook works, for example, and they're asking the founder of Facebook to actually explain how Facebook works. And that tells me if you don't know how Facebook works, then you are actually disconnected with the average American that uses it. So maybe you shouldn't be in office anymore.
Is there an inbuilt problem, Yossi, with all of this, whether with fixed terms or non-fixed terms? And I'm not sitting here pretending I have an answer to this, that campaigning and governing are potentially quite different skills, as that old joke goes, that you campaign in poetry and govern in prose. And you end up with a problem sometimes where you have people who are really good at one of those things but absolutely suck at the other.
I think actually the American system in this sense of two terms works as well as any system can work. We see it, talk about campaigning. Mm. We discussed so many times Israel that had 4 elections in 2 years recently, and it's still unresolved in a government that can't govern because the system works the way it works. I think there is a need to limit them. I'm not so sure about the legislature, because sometimes it's nice to also experience, even they don't understand Facebook, unfortunately. Well, someone can put them up to speed before it actually changed its name to Meta. They are actually still dealing with Facebook, but the experience works. It's a bit like in the UK. Intellectually, it's very difficult to defend the idea of the House of Lords because they are unelected. On the other hand, when you go and talk to people in the House of Lords and you give evidence, actually, they know so much. It's actually a pleasure to talk to people with so much experience. So it's to balance between the two. But there is no, as you said, there is no answer.
Yossi Mecklenburg and Holly Dagres, thank you both for the moment. We will have more from you later in the show. Now, if it had been possible to abide by its original schedule, the annual meeting of the World Economic Forum would be underway in Davos right now. For obvious reasons, it has been punted to the summer. A pointed new book about Davos and the people who attend it has appeared on schedule, however. Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World by Peter S. Goodman, global economics correspondent for the New York Times and a pretty regular guest on Monocle 24. I spoke to Peter about his new book earlier. I began by asking him to describe exactly how he would characterize Davos Man.
Davos Man refers most broadly to the billionaire class. I mean, these are the richest people on earth. They don't operate by the same rules as everyone else. They can fly around on their private jets and float around on their yachts. When pandemics come or when the spirit moves them, they can set up home on any number of private islands. I mean, they're just immune to most of the forces that constrain the rest of us. But there's one other defining characteristic, and that's that Davos Man is not content to simply own houses the way most of us own socks. Davos Man wants our adulation for his innate virtues. Davos Man is full of reasons why we should see economics as a win-win for everyone. If he's doing well, then we're all doing well, despite all sorts of evidence to the contrary.
Is that a new phenomenon, though? Hasn't capitalism always tried to present itself as virtuous? I mean, didn't even the robber barons who built the railways to the West try to persuade Americans that they were performing this act of great civic charity?
Well, yes, to a degree. And let me just back up for a second, because I personally argue capitalism is virtuous. I mean, the idea of a market system, markets are incredibly efficient in terms of allocating resources and getting us products that we want and spurring innovation. What we're living under with Davos Man is a very warped form of capitalism that's not working in the service of most people, where the bounty is really monopolized by a handful of people to the detriment of innovation, to the detriment of consumer interests even. But back to your original question, yes, the robber barons certainly built concert halls, museums, and they said, here's your compensation for whacking labor movements over the head. But they, by and large, were much less creative than Davos Man in arguing that they are actually virtuous. They were content to simply own everything. Davos Man's playing on a whole other level. Davos Man wants us to truly view trickle-down economics, despite evidence to the contrary, as a progressive force for everyone, and to share in these kind of universal gains where he keeps ending up with all the money.
How much of that, though, is necessarily malicious or sinister, and how much of it is just, I guess, the inevitable detachment from reality that often accompanies being fabulously wealthy?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the psychology of wealth suggests that if you actually live differently than everyone else, you're going to become different from everyone else. But, you know, one of the key aims in the book for me is to point out that this is not just sort of happenstance. I mean, we tend to think that, well, we tend to absorb this truth that's been disseminated by Davos Man, this false binary where we either have life as we know it, where we have miraculous vaccines in the face of a pandemic. We have things like Uber and Google and, you know, central air conditioning when we need it, and voluminous choices at supermarkets and clothing stores, all the electronic we like. Either that, or we might as well be living in caves, you know, eating grubs. And obviously, I'm speaking somewhat colorfully, but if you start criticizing the structure of markets, in my profession, I've been writing about economics now for a quarter century, you will quickly get lectured to by lobbyists under the employ of billionaires and multinational corporations that you're anti-business, as if simply wanting regulations or taxation so that the companies that are producing all kinds of fabulous innovation and getting rewarded for it can give something back in the form of infrastructure, education, healthcare. You know, all these things cost money. And it's not an accident that we're living in a world where billionaires are just in common forms engaging in legalized and sometimes not legal tax evasion. In the United States, where I'm living, this is especially pronounced, but it's true in Britain, it's true in Italy, it's true in France, it's really true anywhere there are large numbers of wealthy people. They are warping the mechanism of democracy, not by accident, but by skillful engineering, to liquidate public infrastructure, government programs, while transferring the proceeds to themselves.
Why is it then, do you think, that Davos Man has not yet been adequately constrained? Is it just that one of the advantages of that fabulous amount of wealth is that it enables you to keep a step beyond any attempts for the law to catch up with you? Or has there just not been enough effort made by elected governments?
I mean, that's a key question. For sure, Davos Man is very skilled at taking his money and using it to pull the levers of government to protect his money and his privileges. I mean, Amazon in Washington now employs over 100 lobbyists. Every wealthy individual, every multinational corporation has arsenals of lobbyists, lawyers, accountants who are very skilled in finding loopholes in existing tax codes to allow them to hang on to their wealth while writing rules that create strategically new loopholes and in some cases just gaping holes. That, again, that has happened, you know, most willfully. And the public, you know, let's face it, most people are too busy living their lives. I mean, large numbers of people in the United States now have to work two jobs just to keep the lights on and a roof over their heads. It doesn't give them a lot of opportunity to digest the tax code. But also, you know, Davos Man has succeeded again in selling us on this idea that if you oppose the current structure, you may as well be advocating that we live like they do in Venezuela. And I mean, we really see this, for instance, with vaccines, where all of us are rightfully grateful that the geniuses at pharmaceutical companies have managed to deliver vaccines for COVID in record time. And that's fantastic. But we've been sold this idea that if we criticize the fact that companies like Pfizer and Moderna are racking up tens of billions of dollars in sales while they're selling their vaccines purely to the highest bidder and leaving out the bulk of humanity, that we might as well be, you know, we're ungrateful. We might as well be like Trotskyite redistributionists. There's middle ground here. I mean, there is, we can return to something that actually is capitalism, where the government plays a role in regulating and making sure that the bounty is more equitably distributed. And if we don't do that, then we're putting our democracies at risk.
That was Peter Goodman of the New York Times speaking to me earlier. Peter's new book, Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World, is published by Custom House, available now. This is the Monocle Daily. I'll be back with our panel right after this.
For more than 130 years, Allianz has expanded its business and stretched its brand in new and innovative ways. And while the world looks very different today than it did back in 1890, one truth remains. Allianz's passion for securing people's lives and giving them courage for what's ahead, no matter what. The world is a better place when people have more courage than fear, especially in uncertain times. People seek stability and confidence. By supporting each other and sharing resources across the world, Allianz has helped people to overcome their fears and look to the future with hope and with real confidence. Oliver Bater has been the CEO of Allianz since 2015. Oliver Bater, it's great to talk with you. What kind of clients does Allianz have in the culture and entertainment sphere?
We have, you can't even imagine, we're one of the largest insurance institutions on the planet. So given that we do insure art, we insure museums, we insure the transport of museums, we do insure concert halls, we do insure operas, all kinds of things. So we are everywhere. We advise the foundations behind that in terms of how to invest their money. So we are all over the place. We are all over there, whether that's modern art or old art or archaeological museums. So we are all over the place. We do actually insure movies. We're the world's largest entertainment insurers, which, by the way, got a big hit last year. So when people say, you know, insurers, we're really not paying, it's not true. We had just paid more than 400 million euros last year for the loss of productions of movies. All of these things we do, and it's really cool, but it's a tough business, I tell you. It's not an easy one to be in.
What are the challenges then in catering for this creative world?
The first one, when you think about art, is the exponential growth and value of a lot of these art pieces. So it becomes increasingly difficult to find the insurance capacity. And particularly if you want to move pieces of art, think about moving, you know, an Andy Warhol painting that maybe worth 100 million from one location to another. It is very dangerous. Yeah, lots of things can happen. So that's just gives you one of the challenges. The other one is in the world where governments can decide to shut down movie theaters, museums, movie productions in an instant. How do you calculate and price the risk? Because it's no more accidental. And by the way, there's no diversification. You know, everybody shuts down at the same time. Insurance very much depends on diversification between continents, between events, and over time. So the risks rise and the premium get much higher, and people don't like that. They don't like to pay for the protection very much. As humans, as we said, we are all optimists. Sometimes we are overconfident. So the propensity to ignore these risks is rising with the rise in value, and we need to be very careful about that.
Oliver Bater, CEO of Allianz, explaining why with Allianz you can take confidence in tomorrow. Allianz, behind you for what's ahead.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are our guests Yossi Meckelberg and Holly Dagres. One might imagine that if one could count on one institution to take a robust line against the dissemination of misinformation, it might be the Royal Society, bastion and custodian of the United Kingdom's scientific excellence since receiving its charter from King Charles II in 1660. One would, it turns out, be wrong. The Royal Society has come out against the censorship of various anti-scientific nonsenses from social media, concerned that any such move might actually be counterproductive, that it could nudge the merely conspiracy curious into unreachably deep rabbit holes. Yossi, I for one am not sure what I think about this. The Royal Society don't think social media companies should remove material which they describe as legal but harmful. What do you think?
If it's harmful, it should be removed. And we saw it through the pandemic. If people, you know, the anti-vaccines, about describing COVID as a flu, as a light flu, when you have so many people dead. I think it's actually for the Royal Society. It depends on the level of harm. If it's a matter of health, it's a matter of security, then I think we should have a responsibility to remove it. If it's harmed and said that it's debatable, then I can see that. We want to have a wide range of debate almost about everything. But if it's harmful, or what they suggest, which I think is worse, legalize against, and then we have the law intervenes in every debate, and I think that will make it even worse.
Because the obvious robust comeback here, Holly, is that disinformation does literally kill people. We have seen that occur in many, many cases in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, it is a complicated discussion, because on the one hand, it makes sense. You bury it, it makes it harder for people to find, and then that means it's harder for people to find confirmation bias and make a point of sharing this information. But the other end, I mean, I'm not just talking about pandemic. It could be something like climate change denial, or it could be about flat earth society. I mean, something that's really outlandish, but there are people that actually believe this sort of thing. And I mean, if we were to bury it online, it makes more sense. But then to delete it, are we curbing people's freedom of expression, freedom of speech? And I think when it comes to the pandemic itself, it's definitely proven to be very dangerous. So I think it really depends on what we're discussing here.
And I guess you then end up, Yossi, with that difficult position of who decides what is harmful.
As always, but in society, you always have those who are in position to decide. We put them, whether it's those who are elected or those who have the expertise. And other issues that were, for instance, genocide denial. Mm-hmm. Do we really want to allow this to take...
Well, there are countries which do, of course, maintain laws against that.
Correct. But even if there is no law, do we really want on website genocide denial? And we see, because what it does, it's not only the denial itself. Of course, it's denying justice of those who were the victims of it, but it also encourages certain people to describe themselves as the victims of something false, of the genocide. So it perpetuates conflicts as well with harmful end to this. So I think, yes, there is no absolute answer to that, but you have always the arbiters in society, whether it's expertise, whether it's the courts, whether they're elected politicians. And we need, as everything else, we need a dialogue in society, what is acceptable and what is not.
Holly, is there an argument that it probably, none of this is perfect, but that it might actually be better if social media platforms make these decisions than governments do, particularly some governments who are not themselves known to be big fans of open and transparent discussion?
Well, I certainly think that social media companies should be doing their due diligence, but we see that oftentimes they don't. In the context of Iran, we've seen hashtags, for example, that are actually things that Iranian users put online, things like solidarity hashtags for protest movements. And because they don't have the resources to follow Persian language social media, if the Iranian government decides that's a threat and they're reporting them online and having bots and trolls armies like interact with them, social media companies aren't even looking at that sort of thing. So I think that social media companies try to do their part, but they're not doing enough and they're not being helpful. And with the context of governments, authoritarian governments like the Islamic Republic, you're looking at this and you're saying, well, they certainly shouldn't be getting involved in social media because they see social media as a national security threat.
But just to follow that up, you've been looking at this in the specific context of Iran. Is there also an issue with governments like Iran's themselves disseminating misinformation?
100%. I recently published a report with the Atlantic Council called Iranians on Social Media. And one of the things I talk about is how Iran is using social media to actually silence activists, journalists, and even prominent members of the diaspora. And especially its own people who actually use social media. It's its only means of connecting to the outside world. They use it for economic, political, and entertainment purposes, but they are increasingly seeing this as problematic to the point where they don't see online censorship as enough or even throttling the internet. They're shutting it down during times of unrest, and that's something we're actually seeing being normalized, and it's really problematic.
Yossi, it is a drum I have thwacked from this chair before, but does it basically need to come down to making social media platforms responsible for what is on their platforms, regarding them, that is, as publishers, as opposed to what they prefer to pitch themselves as, merely neutral conduits of information?
I think, as Oli said, we have all due diligence with whatever we do in life. So why the social media platforms won't have? And I think part of what you say earlier is there is a conundrum there, because authoritarian regimes will do anyway what they want to do.
Mm.
This debate is within the democratic paradigm, in which we actually want to assess what not to do it for our own benefits or the benefit of the regime or some specific, but for what is good for society. They are doing for the regime. So now we enter into this discussion that, for instance, the Iranian government, the Islamic government, will do it because they try to maintain their position. But back to your question, I think there is responsibility, and I think the minute there was be legal responsibility to the way they operate, then we'll take it more seriously. And one thing, all right, for instance, if they're going to be fined, heavy fines for certain behaviors, then think, all right, we make profits because we allow everything to go there, but it will going to cost us. And maybe in some cases, even criminal. Now, of course, we need to balance it without curtailing of freedom of speech. But it's a very old argument.
Be coming back to it, I'm sure, one day. Finally on today's show, and this is very much one of those and finally stories, a town called Sunnyvale being beset by flocks of marauding crows sounds like the pitch for an extremely phoned-in streaming series, but is a thing which is happening. Sunnyvale, California, where else, is being plagued by a crow population which has boomed during the pandemic and now appears to believe that it owns the place, disturbing the peace with their cacophony. Cophonous cawing, attempting to steal the food of outdoor diners, rendering swiftly redundant the efforts of local motorists to keep their cars clean. Accordingly, the citizens of Sunnyvale are to be issued with green laser pointers. Holly, what could possibly go wrong?
Oh, I mean... yeah, I mean, the birds won't fight back, right? They're just gonna take it. Oh, boy. I mean, I guess they're going to have to see what happens, right? What could possibly go wrong?
Are you a fan of this idea, Yossi?
Not really. So it's kind of Star Wars against crows. Actually,
what if the crows evolve and adapt and become laser-resistant crows? Is no one in Sunnyvale thinking of this?
It's kind of fighting between air defense and electronic warfare.
Yeah.
But I actually, since we started with moose and bisons, actually, in the UK, we have more issues with seagulls. And in one case, in St. Ives, I had a cone of ice cream, and one of these seagulls decided it liked my ice cream and just in a very impressive way, just landed and stole my ice cream. I didn't cry as much as the 4-year-old that actually his ice cream was stolen. But yeah, I understand it's kind of upsetting, but I think you have to learn to live with nature the way it is.
The British seagull is interesting in that I will concede it is the only item of British fauna which could totally beat up its Australian equivalent. The Australian seagull is actually a slightly weedy, effete, milky toast sort of creature. But to bring this back to Australia, as I so often do, I do want to say that I think the people of Sunnyvale, if any of them are listening, don't actually, I mean, they couldn't be listening because presumably they're just running around all day waving their hands frantically over their head trying to deter crows. But they, I mean, they don't know they're born. These people have not had to deal with a territorially aggrieved Australian magpie. And those are the ones that if you walk under their tree during nesting season, they will come for you. It is a part of an Australian childhood being knocked off your bike by a swooping magpie. And indeed, I have seen for sale in Australian cycling shops target decals that you can put on the top on your cycling helmet to give the magpies something to aim at.
It's wonderful to have in our garden parakeets and jays. They are not that dangerous. They just eat the peanuts. You need a special budget
We were talking earlier about both your encounters with the wildlife of Wyoming, but closer to home, perhaps, have either of you ever had to improvise some sort of deterrent regime to scare anything away? I don't know whether it was a laser pointer or some other thing.
Well, I've always been told that if I was to see a grizzly bear, what to do, even though I've never encountered one.
Go on, please. In case we have a listener tuned in right now who is being menaced by a grizzly bear, this advice could save their life.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, I might get my bears wrong here. But I think the more accurate thing is to actually... present yourself as very big. But I guess... in my case, I'm probably going to get my bears confused anyways. I'm going to get mauled.
Okay. Apologies to that leader being... leader? Listener being beset by a bear who was desperately tuning in for life-saving advice.
The big mistake is to see a grizzly bear cub and think, oh, such a lovely cuddly toy. There is always a mother. Not yep. That far away. That's don't make
See,
this
that
mistake. Sound,
that sounds like good
don't go
advice.
Pet the bear.
Yeah. The worst advice I've ever been given, actually semi-worst advice I've ever been given for dealing with wildlife. I don't know if this is true. If you are now being menaced by an Australian crocodile, don't pay any attention to this. But I was told earnestly that while the muscles which close their jaw are strong enough to snap a human's leg into, the muscles which open their jaw are very weak. So the thing to do is to grab it firmly by the mouth and hold its mouth closed and fine. But my question was, okay, and my next move is...
He still has his paws.
I still haven't had an answer to, now that I have my fingers jammed in the nostrils of a ton and a half of angry Paleolithic Megadeth. Please talk me through the next few seconds. If anyone does have any advice on that front, by the way, do get in touch. You never know when it'll come in handy. That is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Yossi Meckelberg and Holly Dagres. Also to Peter Goodman. Today's show was produced by Chris Chermak and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Lillian Fawcett. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Mullett here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thank you for listening.